out to the second Topic of Legal Defense Fund session of today. Is manga a crime? Criminal prosecutions of manga in the United States and Canada. I'm Charles Brownstein. I'm the executive director of the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, and we are a nonprofit organization that has been around since 1986 to stand up for the rights of comics and manga here in the States. The First Amendment protects the artwork that we all love and enjoy, and frequently we are seeing that the comics are coming under attack, and manga over recent years has been coming under attack as well. So today we're going to talk about the context of these challenges and to talk specifically about a few of the different cases and go into detail about what has resolved this year. The fight to protect comics goes back to our very beginnings. Comics have been the object of controversy since the 1950s when the United States Senate actually held subcommittee hearings to investigate the comic book medium in response to public pressure about its content. I frequently say that the job of young people is to horrify their elders, and we always see this in the context of moral panic about media. And so, when I was a kid and figuring out who I was really into heavy metal music. And at the time, there was all of this public outcry about how Slayer was going to turn your kid into a Satanist that killed cats or whatever. And I became a fruitful member of society. 10 years ago, in the last 10 years, there's been a lot of efforts to restrict video games. And if your kids play video games, they're going to go into schools and shoot up their classmates. Well, you know what? There's plenty of great lawyers and doctors and politicians and fruitful members of society that go home after work and blow off steam playing Call of Duty. They're not going to go out and kill anybody. But see, there's always this argument, this idea that if we let our kids read a certain kind of content, that it's going to turn good kids into bad kids. And it all kind of, really started in this test case of comic books, where in the 1930s and 40s, people said this is lurid trash, and it's low-value speech, and, it's going to hurt young readers, and it's going to warp their sexuality by showing these, sexy jungle pictures, and also Batman and Robin, what's that all about? I bet that's a gay thing, right? It's like just all of these kind of projections by authority figures that were looking at, what young people were interested in, and using the worst case examples, these junk science examples of, we're working at a home for at-risk youth, all of these kids who've done criminal acts read comic books, therefore the comic books made them criminals. Well, no, it's bogus, it's BS, but it was used. It was used in a very popular book called Seduction of the Innocent in the 1950s, which was written by a doctor named Frederick Wortham. And that led to Senate subcommittee hearings that led to public pressure to censor comic books. And so that created what was called the Comics Code Authority. And the code was created a standard where comic books were reduced to the level of, only children and half-wits read it. And it created this stigma in the culture. And so that was not an instance of the law regulating comics, but it created the circumstances where comics are regarded as low value. And so when the medium started to speak dynamically to adult readers with the underground comics, that's when you started to see the law get involved. Now, the underground comics movement emerged out of the 1960s counterculture that brought us rock and roll, that brought us, experimentation with drugs and sexuality and, speaking truth and power in the culture. And the underground movement were artists that were in their early 20s that were making comics that were designed to push the boundaries. And they grew up on Mad Magazine, and they grew up on the horror comics from EC, and they decided, we don't need permission, we just need to draw our book and, hire a printing plant and make these books and get them out there. And so in the early 1970s, you saw the first cases against comics emerge, and there was a comic called Zap Number 4, and there was a strip in there by the cartoonist Robert Crumb, who now hangs in museums, but at the time was this kind of gawky dude that made these brilliantly drawn comics that were just searing social commentary. And so he had a story called Joe Blow in Zap Number 4, which was informed by the fact that Zaps 1, 2, and 3 were the subject of busts in cities like Berkeley, California, and San Francisco, California, and New York. And, the cops would go into the stores and say, this is obscene material, we're seizing it, you know, charging a fine, or whatever the case might be. And so these guys at the New Exam decided, well, we're going to up the ante here because we think that the real obscenity is that they're cracking down on what we have to say. And so in Zap number 4, Crumb made this this comic called Joe Blow, which was this satire of the Leave It to Beaver American suburban ideal. And the twist was, you saw Ma and Pa and Dad and Sis, and they were all, you know, happy on the outside, but behind closed doors, they were having an incest orgy that looks like it was drawn by Walt Disney. And so this was the subject of arrests in San Francisco, but the one where it stuck was in New York. And in New York, of all places, the judge actually found that the material was obscene. Now, this was a judge who, when the expert who came from Harvey Comics, which makes like the Cast of the Ghost comic book and the Hot Stuff comic book, you know, came on the stage and said, well, you know, I make comics that are for juvenile readers, but they can speak to, you know, anyone. But comics, you know, can speak to a lot of different things. The judge says, I beg your pardon, I read your comic books all the time. Whoops, you know, this is a guy that's deciding on the First Amendment rights for adults. And so that was the first time a comic book was found legally obscene. A second wave of criminal cases emerged in 1986 when a retailer in Lansing, Illinois was convicted for possession and sale of obscene materials for selling adult comics to an undercover police officer. And this came after a period where the industry had started to grow. We had established the fan environments like conventions, comic book stores that we see here today. And so we were starting to make comics by fans for fans, and that meant that comics were finally able to speak to adult audiences and adult themes and adult concerns. And it was, you know, also in 1986 that we started to see manga coming to the United States, where Viz Media started that year, and you started to see the first kind of, you know, attempts at bringing manga into the States. And yet there was still this stigma that, you know, comics are for kids, even though we had articles in Rolling Stone about Watchmen, which was, you know, just coming out in single issues at the time, or Dark Knight coming out in single issues at the time, you know, changing the public perception. And so after that arrest in Lansing, Illinois, the industry decided that, you know, we're not going to take it anymore. We're going to stand up and protect our rights, because the First Amendment says that citizens are free to create and read and sell the expressive material they want to without fear of prosecution. And so the fund was formed to wage those cases. You know, we won the case in 86, and, you know, we have, you know, since then been working to defend comics and to create awareness of your rights. And it was in the year 2000 that manga became the subject of legal controversy. Now, manga is an international force. As I'm sure many of you know here, it's a phenomenon that since the, you know, kind of beginnings in the mid-80s of manga becoming this force, it's exploded across TV, it's exploded into bookstores. And the thing is that, you know, this is an imported cultural good from a different culture that has vastly different taboos about sexual conduct and nudity. And this has led to misunderstandings and prosecutions. So, you know, with higher visibility, prosecutions and challenges against manga are increasing. Yet, manga culture is on the rise. There's more than 200 conventions every year, ranging from, you know, little fan events in a hotel where people are, you know, watching videos and swapping books, to, you know, massive events like this one here in San Diego or Anime Expo, which was a few weeks ago. And a generation of readers has grown up on manga. You know, I've met, you know, many people that started, you know, sitting in Borders when they were 11 years old, you know, going through and reading this stuff, who are now adults, who are now at risk. And so as the generation that grew up on manga become adults, so do their tastes. And so people are looking to bring in more of the stuff in Japan, and Japan speaks about everything for everybody. And so since 2000, we've seen the prosecutions begun. And today I'm going to briefly speak about four of them. The first, Texas versus Castillo, the second, U.S. v. Horley, the third, U.S. v. Hanley, and the fourth, the Crown v. Matheson. The first court case began in 2000 in Dallas, Texas, at a store called Keats Comics. Jesus Castillo was a clerk, a comic book store, and a undercover police officer came into the store that day and said, you know, where do you keep the adult stuff? And he goes, right there behind that curtain. And so we think nothing of it, right? It's an adult section, fine. He goes behind the curtain, looks at the adult stuff, comes out and, you know, asks for Demon Beast Invasion and Ruatsuki Doji, the Legend of the Overfiend. And Jesus goes, I don't know, maybe we have it, maybe we don't, because he wasn't familiar with the content, but the cop kept baiting him and then eventually went back and found them. And then brought them to the fore and came back and arrested him for selling what he alleged to be obscene material. Now, these are, you know, these are horror comics that have, you know, some sexually extreme content, but again, it was, this is an adult going into the adult section, buying adult content. So what? But they arrested Jesus, and they brought him to court, and they waged a trial that basically said, comics, and they actually said, you know, comics for kids. So the CDLDF got involved, we brought in very good experts, we argued that the comics in question are protected by the First Amendment. We had Susan Napier, who was an Asian studies expert at the University of Texas at the time. She's since gone on and talked on several documentaries about manga, and she spoke to the cultural merit. Scott McCloud, a comics expert, testified about the artistic merit of the work, but also that comics speak to adult audiences and brought in those statistics. We also had a private investigator show comparable material that was happening in the community. The prosecutors didn't have any experts. And see, here's the thing. In a court of law, if you bring in expert testimony, then there needs to be a an expert to counter that. They didn't have it. Instead, they had these closing arguments that said, and that's Jesus right there. They had these closing arguments that said, I don't care what type of evidence or testimony is out there. You've got to use your rationality and your common sense. Comic books, what we think of as comic books, are for kids. This is in a store directly across an elementary school, and it's put in the medium in a form to directly appeal to kids. That's why we're here, ladies and gentlemen. We're here to get this off the shelf. They also scoffed at the notion that this could be art at all by saying, you know, if you think that this is art, then you put it up on the Jumbotron at the baseball stadium. Well, there's plenty of things that are art you don't put up at the Jumbotron at the baseball stadium that adults are allowed to consume because they're protected by the First Amendment. And unfortunately, the jury sided with the prosecution. And so Jesus was sentenced to 180 days in jail and a $4,000 fine and a year of probation for selling material that should be constitutionally protected to an adult reader. Attempts to appeal the case were unfortunately unsuccessful. We appealed it in... We appealed to the Texas Appellate Court and to the Supreme Court of Texas, and even to the Supreme Court of the United States, who refused to hear the case. But unfortunately, at each point, they found that the legal error was not committed. It was just a bad jury decision. You can't overturn a bad, you know, on those grounds. The only bright side is that, you know, Jesus was ultimately able to negotiate a period of unsupervised probation. But this set the wheels in motion. Shortly after the... prosecution of Jesus, the government passed the PROTECT Act of 2003, and I remember reading this and just a sharp chill going up my spine, because this law, which is a very difficult law, because half of it is really good, it gives us things like the Amber Alert, it gives us stronger penalties on child sex trafficking and child sex tourism, and does a lot of great things to protect real people from being victimized. But it also had this sweepingly overbroad language about a new category of crime called obscene child pornography. And this is any visual content, whether it's a sculpture, a painting, a drawing, a comic, a cartoon, specifically says a cartoon, that includes the sexual description of minors, sexual depiction of minors, the depiction of minors in sexual circumstances is tantamount to child pornography. Now, there's two problems with this law. The purpose of anti-child pornography laws is to protect real people from being harmed. You start with the fact that child pornography is photographic evidence of a crime. It is illustrating, you know, what happened to real people who were harmed, who were coerced into doing something that they don't have consent to do. Drawings are drawings, and art is a safe place to explore our emotions, our identities, and that includes in the sexual sphere. And so, PROTECT is being used to prosecute anime and manga improperly because, A, this is art. This is not the actual depiction of a crime. And, two, it is art that is frequently misunderstood. And so what frequently happens is that customs agents or police officers who don't understand the line style of manga are seeing an art style and going, oh, well, that character has big eyes and is hairless and is simple. That must be a child. This person must be a creeper. And so the first case really to test the Protect Act was U.S. v. Corley. Now, Dwight Corley was a bad defendant. He had a prior on his record. He was actually somebody who had possessed child pornography and was convicted of it. But he was the first time that we saw this law tested. So we didn't get involved in Corley's case. He didn't come to us for aid, nor would we have helped him on any point that wasn't related to comics, because we don't protect anything except the expressive art, and we don't believe that people should be protected if they are engaging in the trafficking of real child pornography. That is a real crime. But the artwork is something else entirely. So Corley used computers at the Virginia Employment Commission and was downloading images, including manga images, and was arrested for printing out two cartoons and viewing others, so 19 counts of violating Protect. And in 2006, a jury found him guilty for receiving obscene cartoons, for which he was sentenced to 20 years in prison and a 10-year probation period thereafter. He was aggravated, as I said, by his prior for possessing real child pornography. So this is not a good guy. But the problem is that he was sentenced under the same guidelines governing actual child pornography for drawings like what you see here. No children were hurt in this particular illustration, and it opened the door to punish people for possessing and receiving artwork. This escalated in the case of Christopher Hanley, who was a manga collector who was arrested in 2006 after postal inspectors viewed a package of manga that he ordered from Japan. Those of you who are aficionados know that there is so much manga content over in Japan that to get all of it, you either got to go over there yourself and bring it back, or you're going to order it from a specialist. And Chris Hanley was a guy who was a real model citizen. He had no criminal record. He was a 40-year-old honorably discharged veteran of the United States Navy. He was disabled. He stayed with his mom at her home and took care of her. She was elderly and disabled. And he was a guy whose twin passions in life were manga and Bible study. He is a guy who was no threat to anybody in his community. And he possessed a full house full of his lifelong collection of manga. Thousands of books, hundreds of DVDs, many computers that, were just loaded with this passionate thing that he loved. And so when he ordered some books from Japan, he was set up to go to the post office and receive it. He was followed home by local police, by FBI, by state police, and they went into his home and they took everything that he had collected all of his life in anime and in manga, and they narrowed it down to a handful of books that would fit on this podium right here, this top 7-10 books. And so he was a collector of manga as a whole, and the vast majority contained no fantasy representations, minors to all. And the problem is that as Hanley went to trial, prosecutors didn't distinguish between manga and obscene material. You still encounter that law enforcement still, in some cases, tends to think that manga or anime are code words for porn. And so when Hanley would look at mainstream sites like Anime News Network, they go, aha, he's looking for more of the stealthy stuff. Well, no. He's engaging in this culture, but he wasn't allowed to access computers. He wasn't allowed to engage in internet chat, so that means he wasn't allowed to adequately prepare his own defense. He was also forced to undergo mental health counseling because they were alleging that looking at the anime genre and looking at the manga genre was harmful. And unlike Corley, who was convicted of mere possession of so the thing with Hanley is this gives a heads to the verdict. Is that he didn't do any harm to anybody. We were asked to come in and help prepare for his defense, and we engaged expert witnesses, but we weren't allowed to run his defense, which is a shame, because when you read the government sentencing documents, it's heartbreaking. He is a 40-year-old guy, and he was forced to undergo these humiliating tests, and it was found in the course of psychological testing that this 40-year-old guy is a virgin. And they say in the opening arguments of the government's sentencing document, this is an unusual case about an unusual man. We acknowledge that you know, he's no threat to anybody in his community, but because, you know, he admits to having looked at these comics and received sexual gratification from fantasizing about being the victim of these comics, that he's a sexual deviant. And first of all, the government has no business going into anybody's private life in that fashion, because he didn't hurt him. Second of all, and you know, this is all tribal and this is all Earth 2 stuff, boy, if we could have gone to court, is, okay, so this is somebody whose only outlet for this very important part of our humanity, because sexuality is the most, you know, important force of creation, because it is the force of creation, we all think about it one way or the other, is that he is looking at being the person in this comic that's abused as, you know, what he's identifying with to explore himself in this same place. They're saying that exploring his own intellectual issue with this is a crime. You know, that's really problematic and that's really chilling. The only bright side of Hanley, who pled guilty rather than face mandatory minimum sentences, is that the government found that the images of minors had to be found to be obscene. And what that means is that artwork like Crumb, artwork like Phoebe Blochner, who are exploring the sexuality of minors in their work, like Phoebe's work deals a lot with sexual abuse, if it does not look like it will be a slam dunk obscenity thing, then, you know, they don't necessarily go after it. Whereas before, any depiction, you know, even depictions that we thought, you know, that like Phoebe's, that are dealing with serious issues, was against the law. So this one did move it into a jury has to find it obscene, and that is positive. But we are also seeing that, unfortunately, a set of precedent where governments can go after it, do go after the people for drawn material. So Chris was sentenced to 6 months in prison to be followed by 3 years of supervised release and 5 years of probation. It's horrifying. An American had to go to jail and had to be subject to re-education, basically, for looking at art. And this is a problem that isn't going away. And this is a problem that CBLDF is really engaged in helping to turn around. These are the titles that Chris was ultimately convicted for receiving. Seven books. Seven books out of a lifetime of exploring the vast, rich, and important culture of anime and manga. The next case that came up is the first real victory for the cases against manga in the U.S. and in Canada. In 2010, there was an American citizen, Ryan Matheson, who was going for a visit and met with some resistance. And he fought back courageously and he won. And today we're going to ask him to come up and tell his story. Brian, welcome. As Brian comes to the stage, I want to tell you, this is one of the bravest people I've ever met, because he was facing obstacles that nobody should ever face, and was really abused by the authorities, but you had the courage and the guts to really stand up for yourself, man, and that's really laudable. We're glad to be here. So can you tell us a little bit, can you start at the beginning?
Or do you want me to go through the story?
Yeah, how you feel about it.
All right, so the story goes back in 2010. I was planning my first real trip on my own out of the country to visit my friend in Canada. I met this friend online, and so it was a chance to meet him in person. And so I was really excited about this trip. And so I packed up all my stuff. You know, me and my friend are both programmers. And so I packed up my stuff. I thought I could go over there. We could program stuff together. We could play games. And so I just went for it and got to the Ottawa airport and ended up being the last in line, or second last in line. And so the customs officials asked to go get searched. Got searched and got searched a lot. And it went on for so long that they had to move to the back room, and they searched more, and after a while they arrested me, and finally went through this 5 days in jail, and finally got out on bail, and then that was my trip. So,
I mean, when did they, you know, if we back up a bit, like you were going through for oops, wow, that one's loud. You were going through for the first time, and, you know, can you talk to me about how they flagged you in the first place, and then, you know, the actual search experience?
I think it was a combination of things that triggered me being searched in the first place. It was a combination of, well, I was bringing, like, my laptop, my iPad, my iPhone, like, all these electronics, and that sets them off, because they asked twice, they asked, what are you bringing? And I told them, I'm bringing all these electronics. And the other thing is that it was my first time using my passport, so, and first time entering Canada, so that definitely makes them search you. And I think my theory is that I was at the end of the line, so... Mm-hmm. The way that customs works is they go in waves, and so a plane lands and they search everyone. And for people at the end of the line, they have more time to search. After that, I think they weren't really concerned about like searching other things in my bag. The things they were really concerned about was the electronics. I think that's the biggest point. They open up my laptop, they asked me to log in, and I said, sure, because I didn't have anything to hide, so why not? Let's just get this over with. And so they log in, and it was actually two people searching me for some reason, and they just started searching forever, for 4 hours. And they searched my iPad and iPhone, too, but that was pretty quick.
What did they tell you while they were doing this? Did they tell you why? Did they tell you what they were thinking?
I think it was after a while, probably 20 minutes, they found some images. They said, oh man, you shouldn't have this stuff, why are you bringing this here? And I was confused, and so they showed it to me, and it was a scan of an art book I have, and I was thinking, well, what's the big deal? And so they just kept searching. I was pretty confused the first half of it. I really didn't know what was going on. And so finally I said, we're going to have to detain you. We're not going to arrest you, but we're going to detain you for further searching in the back room.
What were the images? Can you describe like what raised their hackle?
The images that I saw were just art books. It was scans of art books. Like it showed a girl wearing a dress, and as soon as they saw anything anime-related, they really got set off on that.
What happened? Because I think you had like a... wasn't your wallpaper anime-related?
Yeah, I had an anime wallpaper.
And I think, you know, once you told me, like, you know, they saw the wallpaper and, like, their eyes lit up, it's like...
Right. So I had a really tame anime wallpaper. It was a Arisa from Kaon, and it was just a really standard wallpaper you can find all over the place, but as soon as they saw that, I saw their eyes just get really wide, like, oh, we've got someone real bad here.
And so what happened when, you know, you're at the airport and they informed you, you know, you're not leaving the airport, you're coming with us. Can you talk to me about that?
What happened is there's two guys, and one guy was always searching my computer. The other guy just kept talking to me, I don't know, to distract me or something. And he kept telling me what was going on. He was saying, oh, you know, 15 more minutes and we're going to have to let you go legally. And then 15 minutes passed and he didn't let me go. And then another 15 minutes passed and he showed up. And so at that point, I was pretty sure I was not going to go see my friend at that point.
God, that's awful. So they've, you know, that was just the first violation of your rights. And, you know, they didn't let you speak to the American consulate, right? Can you talk to me about, you know, can you talk to me about that process, about, you know, being denied access to
necessities and being denied, you know, access to help.
Okay, so originally, it was really confusing in the first half. Like I said, I really didn't know what was going on. And so they asked me, do you want to see the U.S. Embassy or anything like that? And I said, no, why would I want to see the U.S. Embassy? I just want to get through customs, you guys.
And this is like in the first half hour.
This first half. And then after I got arrested and they put me in a jail cell, then I started really kind of freaking out. So then I thought, well, I really should talk to the U.S. Embassy now because this is really serious now. And so, I kept bugging guards that walked by, and one of them was a female police officer. And I asked her, can I please speak to the U.S. Embassy? And she said, well, I don't think we have one of those here. And then I said, no, please go talk to the U.S. Embassy. I need to talk to them. And then she said, oh, I'll go talk to the lieutenant or something, and walked off. And I never saw her again.
And so, you know, the police were immediately very very derisive towards you and just very cruel. Can you talk to me about, you know, that experience?
Well, in addition to the whole embassy thing, you do not want to be in jail, let me tell you that. They say you get a bed, but you don't. They get you a really cold slab of concrete. And so I was thinking, well, I need something so I can at least not get hypothermia or something. So I kept asking for blankets. I hadn't eaten since I landed, and so I was really hungry. And I asked for food probably 6 times, and they kept saying, we'll go ask the chef for some food. And now that I look back on that, they were probably making fun of me. And so they never got me food until the next day. And so what I did end up getting was toilet paper. So at least I got that.
The one that, you know, just makes me infuriated every single time I encounter it is what they told you when you were being transported and, you know, put into, you know, the protective custody. Can you talk to me about that? It's really upsetting.
Well, when they transport you, you're supposed to be in isolated custody, so they kind of sort of did that. At one point, they didn't put me in the separate custody, but besides that, when I finally got to the detention center place, they were getting me ready to go into the jail cell and saying, if you're in protective custody, you must have done something really bad, something child-related, right? And so I just kind of nodded lightly at them, and they said, you got to come up with something like assault. So I guess they must have assumed it was child rape or something. And then they said, if you get raped in here, it doesn't count, you know? And so I just kind of looked at them and I said, that really doesn't make me feel much better. Just went into the jail cell after that.
So how did this... So you were there for 5 awful days. Can you tell me about finally getting out and also the conditions that you were placed under when you learned that they were accusing you of importation of child pornography?
So after 5 days, it was 2 days in the police jail and 3 days in the detention center, I think. Finally they let me out. They delayed it as long as possible, of course, to get me out on bail. But finally I got out. I went on a video bail with the judge, and the lawyer that I had said, okay, we got you out. And he said he wasn't really happy with it, but he got me these conditions, and it was basically, the conditions were basically, you can't live your life, sorry. And he listened to me like, you can't possess a computer, you can't use the internet outside of one specific company. They named the company. You can't use anything that can be used or that can access them, and all sorts of things like that. On top of these other obvious things like no pornography, you can't talk to children that don't have a relative or someone 18 plus with them or something like that. And so that was probably the hardest part of going through it, because as a programmer, I kind of use my computer all the time. It's kind of my life. Especially in the first year, I could only work at this one company, and they had my hours down to like less than 10 hours a week. so I wasn't making much money. But after a year, they released that, so it was, I can work for any company, basically.
And you know, one of the things that's so upsetting about this case is that the images we're talking about are really nothing. And, you know, one of the things that's always upsetting is, you know, on the internet it's easier to say something snarky than to say something sincere. And, you know, I was kind of amazed by the assumption that, you know, you must have had something bad. But, you know, the next slide... You know, this is one of the images that they were saying is so awful that they can't let it into Canada. You know, this is an image that they said is the same as the sexual abuse of real children. And, you know, this is a humor image, you know, called the 48 Positions Moe style. I mean, you know, Google it, you'll find it. You'll find it in 2 minutes. You know, this is a parody of an image, the 48 sumo positions, which was then later parodied as the 48 sexual positions, and this was parodied in the Moe style. And, you know, the officers in your case, you know, didn't understand the art enough. And so, you know, they were, I mean, what did they say to you about this art? They, you know, that, you know, they felt that this was like children, right? And but it's clearly chibis.
Yeah, for this particular, I think it was for this particular image. I never actually saw the evidence because they don't let you see the evidence in Canada unless you go to the police station. But in the police documents, they said this was a depiction of 5-year-olds engaged in sexual activity. I don't know how they got that age. I really don't. They're not 5-year-olds, but that's what they came up with.
Just, you know, it's just terrible. And then, you know, the other one was like a doujin, right?
Yep.
Could you describe that to me in the circumstances of that?
Yep, so it was a manga derived from Magical Girl Nerubo Kanha. It was actually from the Striker series. And if you know the Striker series, it's when all of the girls grow up. They're all adults. And so that's that particular one they're talking about. And the reason why they went for that is because... in one of the stories, it featured the Reinforce, which is basically a computer program that looks like a little fairy sort of thing. And so they thought that was definitely a child, even though if you looked at the proportions, there's no way you could possibly rationally think that was a real child.
And so, you know, they're accusing you of the worst crime in the world for these images that are nothing. You know, and you know, not even you know, depicting anything that is, you know, is explicit. Because I mean, there are the genres like Lolicon that, you know, do get into explicit material, and even those are only drawings. Nobody should go to jail, you know, over drawings, because that's about, you know, the imagination. That's about, you know, confronting, you know, one's own issues. And, you know, I spoke in Tokyo in May, and I saw, you know, on the fifth floor of a bookstore is all, you know, male-oriented adult manga. And on the fourth floor is all female-oriented adult manga. And it's not, you know, taboo to look at sexually-oriented content. And so, you know, it's the opposite of here, where everything's kind of photographic in its nature in our porno culture. And it's voyeuristic in its nature, you know, and it's taboo. It's hidden. It's something that people do, you know, in private and look at it in private, unless it's, you know, a consumer good like Game of Thrones. And, you know, and that's where, you know, you kind of sneak sexuality in, and it's okay if it's in the context of this thing you can buy. You know, in Japan, it's not really frowned upon. It's ubiquitous that, you know, people are sexual creatures, and we look at things that address this part of our life, and it's about the imagination. And so, you know, it was a real eye-opener to walk into those stores and see that, you know, stuff that we automatically go, well, loli should be against the law in the States because that encourages perverts. Well, no, actually in Japan, it's you're exploring an emotional state through art as a safe place to find who you are and what you're interested in, and you're not actually going to engage in that behavior. You know, it's about confronting who you are in your life. And, you know, we're not even talking about that stuff in your case. You know, we're talking about something that's really mundane.
Yeah, that's the really irritating thing about it is that it wasn't anything like that. I mean, it was two images, and what really set off the customs aides was stuff that, it's, like I said, art books. I know that a couple images they looked at was from one of, I don't know if you know them, but there's an artist called Tinkle. Tinkle makes like some of the best art I've seen, in my opinion. And it was a very, very, very high quality art book. And but they saw it, they said, we don't like what this looks like. And then, you know, that set them off.
So this was a horrible interruption of 2 years of your life, and you reached out to us in the middle of it, and fortunately, the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund's board of directors was able to help us get involved with collaborating with the Comics Legends Legal Defense Fund in Canada to fund your defense, and the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund here in the United States helped your firm, Edelson Clifford D'Angelo, put together just a ridiculously good defense. We had, you know, great experts ready to deploy and connected them with, you know, some resources. So could you talk about, you know, briefly the quality of the defense and then we can move to the outcome.
Yeah, my defense was pretty ridiculous. But, I mean, it is actually kind of hilarious if you look through the defense articles. Because, I mean, it wasn't, I mean, before you even get to the defense part of it, there were so many of these bad things, the legal things the police did, but when you get to the defense part, it's like there's no way they would have won. And so, I mean...
They, you know, and what's so courageous, Ryan, is that there was a moment where they were trying to get you to plead. And I'd like you to talk to me about, you know, why you didn't.
Yeah, so the way plea bargains works is that...
And this is like 1 year in, right?
Yeah, so yeah, all I can talk about before that, I mean, originally they didn't let there be any plea bargaining except for the original crime, and so they tried to reduce it down to like 2 weeks, 14 days in jail. We kept kind of trying to get it down to obscene material, which is still a criminal offense. And so, at one point, I was like this close from just saying, okay, and I was just going to go for it. And I thought, well, you know, I can just spend 2 weeks in jail. That's not too bad. I can get through that. You know, but then I, you know, at that point, I called my mom that night to tell her what I was going to do. And then she said, if that's what you believe it is, then I'm fine with that. But she didn't want me to plead guilty to something I didn't think I was guilty to. So she basically said, if you believe the stuff you love is obscene, then she's okay with it. So I hung up and I thought about it for a while, and then I got really, really upset. Like, I was boiling, I was raging, and I was thinking, this is ridiculous. How can I just, it's like, how can I say that this is obscene? Like, this is not obscene. That is absolute crap. That they are completely wrong. And so, I just got to come back. I went into rage mode, and I was so angry, and so, at that point, I got... I don't know if you want to say reckless. And at that point, I said, I don't care if I have to go to jail for a year or 2 years. I'm going to fight for this because I was very pissed off.
And it's great that you did. And, you know, ultimately, you know, customs backed down. Ultimately, the Canadian government backed down and they dropped the charges. And it sets a good example that you had the courage to fight back for that, and we thank you.
Yeah, I think that what they try to do, and I think they probably do this in all prosecutions, is they try to scare you. They try to say, well, this is definitely illegal, this is definitely bad, you're a bad person. You know, when I got to the police station, one of the other police officers there, it was a woman, asked, well, what's this guy in for? And then the guy brought me and told her, and she glared at me like I was the worst person in the world. And I didn't understand why are you glaring at me like that? And so what prosecution tries to do is make you believe that you're guilty. They try to play these mind games with you, and I think the conditions are part of that. But in reality, if you go all the way to the end, they realize they don't have a case. And that's why it took until it was like a week or two before my trial date, before they finally actually started to negotiate with my lawyers for a reasonable plea bargain. But before that, they wouldn't budge, and they kept swapping with prosecutors. And then with their like four prosecutors, they kept dropping for some reason.
And in the end, the cases were resolved. The case was resolved in a fashion where, basically, you're saying that I brought something into the country you don't want in the country. You know, it wasn't criminal. It wasn't, and so all criminal charges were dropped.
Yeah. They dropped all the criminal charges.
So you know, this was a victory, but it was a hard-won victory. Thanks to your support, the folks that have donated to the Common Book Legal Defense Fund, we were able to pay down. What is the number now? $45,000 of your $75,000 defense? Anyway, it was a $75,000 defense, and the Common Book Legal Defense Fund has been able to contribute $30,000 to it so far. The Comic Legends Legal Defense Fund has been able to contribute $11,000 so far. We're seeking contributions to restore the remaining $34,000 to Ryan that he and his family had to pay before we became involved, and we're doing it with the support of folks like you. And we're also going out into audiences like this and raising awareness that these things are happening. You know, there's a case that I'm working on in the Midwest right now that, you know, we're real close to killing an investigation against a fan for possession of manga that, you know, he was illegally searched and seized. These things are still happening. Tell your friends, tell your community, manga is not a crime. Manga is protected speech, and it's up to us to stand up for the rights of what we love. And right now, I'd like to, you know, stand up and applaud Ryan for having the convictions in what he's done. Thank you.